Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
Are equities still a good deal right now? They've been on a terrific run lately.
Year to date, they've had one of the best starts in the last 40 years. So definitely a big rebound now, really concentrated in particularly the big tech companies that have had references to AI in all of their latest earnings statements and calls. So there's just been a lot of hype and mania around this idea that artificial intelligence is going to change the world. And I think, you know, longer term, it's definitely going to have a big impact. The question is, you know, is the trajectory of revenues, sales, economic activity on an up or downswing here? And I think that the issue or the problem with the surge in prices of equities is that it has really disconnected from the fundamental picture of the ongoing downturn. So, for example, today the U.S. Fed has hiked rates another 0.25. Now we're in the 5.25 to 5.5 category. Jim, this is a full 500 basis points higher than we were in March of 2022. You know, they've only ever hiked that fast three other times in history. That was 1973, 79, and 81. And those were all they were all followed by deep recessions. And there's a reason for that, right? The cardiac arrest hits the economy, especially an economy that's highly levered and indebted. And as we know, we have the highest level of debt in the world today that we've ever had. Consumer credit card debt, revolving credit, all of that, in Canada in particular, but in many places around the world, is the highest that it's ever been. And now we've got interest rates at the highest that we've seen in more than 20 years. So that combination has really been quite lethal in terms of the, you know, burning through any excess savings people had from the pandemic infusions and all the subsidies that were handed out. So you have, you know, the IMF coming out and saying that their latest projection shows a 1% GDP growth forecast for 2024. The Bank of Canada sees about 1% for Canada. You know, these are essentially stall speed economies. We've got the Canadian unemployment rate already on an uptrend, you know, around 5.4% from a low of 4.9% in 2022. And all of the major banks are forecasting that the Canadian unemployment rate will rise probably another percent over the next year. And basically at the margin, that is the last piece of this puzzle. You know, the unemployment rate has remained low, and many people have used that as a sign or a hope that that meant that the economy was not going to go into a contraction or a downturn. Unfortunately, that is a lagging indicator, as I've mentioned many times, and it typically spikes up about a percent, a little over a percent, about 12 months into a recession. So the fact that it's been moving higher in Canada is suggestive that, you know, it's likely on a trend to do that further over the next year. As I say, with these lower economic outputs, the credit crunch that's going on in the overall economy, you know, Chair Powell's comments, I think, are going to have to stay on the hawkish side here, even if they're done, you know, even if they don't hike anymore. Right now, there's still talk of them hiking further in the fall. I think that the pace of the economic decline is going to be the thing here, right? So if it, we've got a lot of problems going on in the commercial real estate space. We've got a lot of problems going on in the retail space. As I said, the banking system's under a lot of pressure. You've got rising defaults. Bankruptcies are spiking. You know, these are not surprise events, Jim. This is just the math of the situation. When you look at how much debt is being carried, much of it was taken on at really abnormally, freakishly low levels when the interest rates were cut during the pandemic. And as those debts come up for renewal, some of it's floating. We're already seeing, you know, HELOCs over 7%, auto loans over 8%, you know, mortgage rates coming up around the over 7% in the U.S., over 6% in Canada. All the variable rate stuff has already floated way up. So it's a fundamental problem overall. Rents are still really bonkers. I've been observing this trend in Canada, particularly in places like Toronto, where landlords have been extorting insane levels of not just rent, but reporting and, you know, getting for people trying to rent apartments, asking for lump sums of a year's rent up front, and, you know, co-signers and asking to see investment statements and character ref, like, it's just over the top bonkers. At the same time, you know, in places like Palo Alto, Silicon Valley, in that area, they had that kind of conditions in their housing bubble run up in 2006-2008. Then everything burst, prices crashed, and then, you know, the favor tipped in front of, in favor of the tenants again and away from the landlords, and they weren't able to extort so much. So that's, I think, what's coming next in Canada, is that, you know, most of the pressure that's being put on the rental market right now is because landlords are being squeezed as well from a sense of their costs have gone up so significantly. You know, I've been writing about them having negative carry properties coming into this rate spike. This was when rates were low. Many were making negative carry because the price portion was so insane. So many times your relative income that you either the borrower had or that you could get in rents, it just made no sense. And now that you've seen this massive uptick in borrowing costs, you know, I've said this several times, but if you do the math, many people today could not afford to buy the house they currently live in if they had to qualify at current rates. And we know that, you know, we've got like about $300 billion or so of Canadian mortgages coming up for renewal in each of, you know, over the next 6 months, and then the year after that, and the year after that. And those people are going to have a hard time refinancing, and unless rates get cut really quickly from here. And I just don't think central banks are in a position to promise or to move on rate cutting. They may indeed pause at some point here. I think they're getting very near the end of where they can possibly hope to increase rates. But I think that the issue is going to be the pause, and people are hoping it, you know, it'll be over quick and they'll run to the rescue with cuts soon. But with food inflation going back up, Jim, you know, the Russian problem in Ukraine, you've got the wheat market soaring again, you've got gas and oil prices up again on Russian cuts and production cuts and Saudi cuts and all the stuff that they've been trying to, you know, boost up their profit margins. Well, that filters through to the consumer, who's already, as I say, in a bit of a cardiac arrest here. So I think that the economic stuff is going to continue to disappoint. I think finally in 24, the central banks may indeed look to ease. But those cuts, even if they do, you know, a full percentage cut, which they did several times heading into the 2007-08 downturn, when they realized the economy was in a recession, they did start cutting dramatically, but it still took, you know, a year and a half for the stock market to bottom. And it still takes several years typically for housing to bottom once the price cycle starts down. So I just think we're in for a long slog here. People need to be cognizant of the lags and the time that it takes for these things to play out. And also, you know, the knock-on effects, they're pretty unpleasant.
How does one protect yourself from this? It's clear that the central banks are going to keep hiking rates until people are thrown out on the streets, either from their homes or from their jobs or both. How do you gird your loins, so to say?
Well, unfortunately, the right thing to do, as I explained when rates were really low, was to use cheap money to get out of debt, right? That was the gift of really low interest rates. Cheap credit could have been used to, you know, double up payments and get out of debt faster, in which case people would have been set up for this inevitable give back period in a much more secure way. Unfortunately, the opposite happened. People saw that rates were low and borrowed even more, right? So the average home prices were, in many areas, were 8 to 10 times household income. Absolutely insanity. Make no sense whatsoever. And historically, any time we've seen those kind of metrics, they've come back to haunt people. And it ends up being that they, you know, so, like, you've got the whole 10 years or so, 12 years of very low interest rates, QE, central banks, you know, slashing rates at the slightest sign of fatigue and consumption. They really just kicked the can down the road. And they've left us in this horrible condition where most people are totally oblivious to how insane things got. Talk about frogs in a boiling water pot. You know, the madness was, you know, going on so long that pension funds all went in, something like 30% of their assets went into these alternative, private equity, illiquid, real estate based, you know, all these sort of opaque instruments to somehow make yield, meet target in the low rate environment. At the same time, individuals went way far out the risk curve. So whatever money they had in terms of long-term savings, you know, that was left over after they were trying to pay for their excessively priced housing, and cars that they were, you know, leasing and borrowing to buy and all that sort of thing. Any savings they had left was going into increasingly aggressive, you know, speculative grade instruments that were being sold because they generate the highest fees for the companies that create them, and the, you know, advisors typically make the most on that kind of product. And so that's what people were getting their savings pushed into. Now the problem is, of course, it's all highly correlated. So again, everything that went up on low rates is now going to have a difficult time going down, in staying up in this environment. And we've seen these trends already as things peaked out in 2021 in some cases, in 2022. We're still, I realized, you know, the big rally in the S&P year to date has taken it about just over 4% from the all-time high in late 2022. But that is pretty typical of these periods where you go in with extraordinarily high valuations and slowing economic growth, and the rate of change just goes negative. And then you get these rebound reflex rallies in asset markets. So I guess all of this to say that I don't think the bear market's over. I think it was a hell of a bounce that happened in the past, few months, all driven by this mania thinking that if central banks start cutting rates soon, it'll solve all the problems. It's not going to solve all the problems. A lot of people borrowed more than they ought to have. I've said this before, but many people will have to go through bankruptcy or restructuring, insolvency, talk to trustees in bankruptcy. A lot of the people that own, or a good amount of people that bought houses that were too expensive, will not be able to keep them in this environment. They will have to list them for sale. People, unfortunately, did things like take lump sums out of their own house on a mortgage to try and help their relatives or their children, and that help will prove to be pretty dangerous for everyone concerned, because, you know, the housing that the person bought is probably going to come down significantly. We're starting to see this in properties all around the Greater Toronto Area where, you know, prices that were, you know, sold, housing that was purchased 2 years ago is selling for 20% less now on the resale market. So, yes, there's still this, you know, need for affordable rentals and single-family homes, starter homes. A lot of people are still trying to buy those, but there's a hell of a lot of inventory that's very expensive, way out of reach now at current rates, and that stuff's going to need to be liquidated. There's been a bunch of private equity firms that have been handing keys back, you know, mailing in, skipping payments. A couple of really big ones this month happened with regard to a loan for a bunch of hotel chains. You know, there is a contagious impact here when people who are all holding the same kind of asset class all need to raise cash at the same time. That's a classic cash crunch, and I think we're starting to see evidence of that all around. As I say, the tide has gone out here, and you know what they infamously say, when the easy money tide goes out, it's when you see all the problems, and that's really starting to become abundantly clear everywhere that we look.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, Canada plans to welcome up to 1 million immigrants a year. Apparently, 1 million people moved in last year. Do we have the housing for these people, and do we have the jobs?
Well, I think, I understand the longer-term push for hiring immigration, given our very low replacement rate and low birth rates, and that's not likely to change given the developed nature of our economy. I understand why the government is looking to, you know, try and bring in younger workers, younger participants, people to pay into the entitlement programs, all that sort of thing. So generally speaking, I'm in favor of immigration. My father was an Irish immigrant. Like, I'm not negative against immigration. However, having said that, it seems to me that there's no reason that we couldn't take a break. You know, like, who's to say we have to have this level every single year, regardless of the bottlenecks and problems it's causing in the services sector or in the housing sector? As I say, I think there's going to be a lot more availability or supply coming available for, you know, either lower rents or lower purchase prices, although immigrants traditionally don't buy housing within the first 7 years of coming to a new country. That's sort of typical. So it's not like they're coming to buy up all this expensive real estate off of Canadians. But I do think that it's not a bad idea to take a break or to reduce the target in the near term, because we, as I say, we've already got this rising unemployment rate that's going to tick up. By all estimates, even the most conventional bank economists, which typically are bullish long-term, are seeing this problem with rising unemployment. And as I say, it's at the margin historically. That just intensifies the credit crunch and the fact that people are having a hard time meeting bills. So yes, I think that it isn't a bad idea to wait now and not bring in the influx, but I'm not sure that that's the plan.
Often we're told the current government likes to welcome migrants because they're more likely to vote for the government that welcomed them into the country. Is there a political reason behind this mass immigration?
I mean, who knows? Possibly, but typically after a couple of terms of one government, you end up getting a switch to the other party, and frankly, they're both about the same as the other as far as I'm concerned. They're both pretty much captured by the vested industries and sectors. They're not very good at forging new ideas and innovation or supporting the directions that we need to go in. And, you know, I don't really see a big change in any of the status quo parties and the ideas. It's all pretty conventional. They've all doubled down on inflating the price of housing. You know, it's so ironic that the central banks are talking about trying to curb inflation that they created by all the easy money years. It's just like, you know, the government's talking about, you know, they're going to have to do something about affordable housing when they helped inflate the bubble through all the very accommodative policies, tax deduction, principal residence, like all of this stuff, having very lax regulation, allowing banks to lend such massive amounts. You know, we should have capital gains caps in terms of principal residence exemptions in this country. No one wants to hear any of this, but the math is what it is. And the problem is that we can't continue to just pay out entitlements and benefits and, you know, run in deficits as far as the eye can see when you've got normalized interest rates like we have today. And I think that even if they cut interest rates, you know, 200 or 300 basis points as the economy slows down, it's not going to, you know, rescue much of the carnage that's already been created here. So we're in a cleanup period, and I don't think any government is going to have an easier time with that than the other.
When opposition members say it's all about affordable housing or we'll do more for affordable housing, how can they do more for affordable housing? What would the process be?
The best thing to do for affordable housing is to let interest rates stay at the current rate and to stop bailing out and subsidizing people who got in over their heads, and let the process play out, which is, you know, distressed assets get sold, the prices have to go down, bad debts get written off. We're starting to see that in the sector. It's certainly happening in the commercial real estate sector. It's going to filtrate through to the housing, the residential or the household sector. And certainly we're seeing that even in the consumer bankruptcy filings and things that are happening. So it's a messy process. And everyone sort of gets concerned when the cleanup crew arrives, when the undertakers arrive, Jim, which are the banks, bankruptcies and trustees. But ultimately, that's the mechanism that a free and democratic society has to clean up the mess of these excessive periods. So during the excessive period, you know, doing something about to lower the price of housing is the thing we have to do. It's allowing prices to come down. It's not trying to goose them further by giving people more credit. That's ultimately totally self-destructive.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at How Street, or maybe it's called X now. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.